Blog Talk Radio.
Found us and we're doing well, and I hope you are too. It's some interesting times, I guess. Somebody told me that's a Chinese curse. May live in interesting times. I've never quite understood it until lately. I'm one of those people that always push back on boring. I always thought that if I'm going through life, I should get something out of it. So it should be something engaging, stimulating. And if I'm fortunate, something rewarding. Then, that's the silver lining in the dark cloud kind of thinking, I realize. But it's been very helpful for a lot of people, including me. The interesting times are, I'm not so fearful. It's amazing that some of these things go on, and then it's not so amazing. What's interesting is, as Churchill, as we're going to talk about, the further back you go, the further forward you're likely to see. The history puts this in context. And these notions of threads and continuity and spectrums, well, if I apply that kind of thinking to what's happening around me, it begins to make sense. It's like things repeating, or in another way, instead of looking at it linearly with repeats, it's like loops. We seem to be able to loop. I thought it was so interesting a very great, great, great long time ago. I was thinking it was I was taught that all of the plays that we have written today around the world are derivative of the themes that were first portrayed in Greek theater. I don't know if it was fascinating to think in a way that the Greeks invented. I don't know if we invent things much anymore. As I don't know if discovery is invention. I'm not creating something out of nothing and sort of putting the pieces together. The printing press was. It was just a fabulous story for me as Daniel Boorstin's work he just reveals how all these historic and technical properties came together. Things sort of merged and came together at the right time. And lo and behold, the printing press and movable print and ink and paper. I began to think that to take these things more seriously, and to my stunning relief, it took me, the questioning took me to where people were working on answers and theory. A long time ago, I lost track of only doing things because there was some visual proof. If I didn't see it, it didn't exist. I'm not quite that vain anymore. A lot of things out of mind it makes sense, and I like the modern science is just taking me and us, I think, further than I could have ever imagined in my wildest dreams. I hope you apologize if you find it tedious that an old man will talk about how amazing it is to hold, figuratively hold the knowledge of the entire world in the palm of my hand. And I'm sitting here with you and through a microphone, and I have a smartphone in my hand and right beside my iPad, all the knowledge. Instead of going into a library, maybe it's the same thing. In order to make use of all of that information, I need a question and a purpose. And as soon as that happens, I can search and find. It's like going through it for me. It's like going through the library stacks, and when I can still, I remember walking into a university one day for early days, and being overwhelmed with the library, and being quite impressed and grateful later to the professional librarian to help me with my research. Just the being able to slow down and sink myself into that atmosphere. I never quite escaped it. And some of the libraries are brilliant, and I feel quite comfortable in them. And I still think that way. It's like, if you speak a few languages, which language do you dream in? Well, that's your primary, it's said that when you dream in a language, then you've acquired that language. I still think in terms of the stacks, and I still think like you, walking through them and noticing, this damn peripheral vision. I'm there for this material and I find this material, but I notice that. And sometimes it was as simple as turning around and looking at what was on the stack behind me. All this acquired information, just this body of work. And I used to think that it was just I was just being frivolous, that I'd pick something up and start reading it. But after a great long time of doing it, I realized how much information I acquire. And it's not always immediately at my fingertips, but there's the hint of it. There's the footprint of it. And I have the sense that I know where to look for answers, just like you, and just like many people, many other people. What I like is being in the presence of people that show me a different way of thinking, show me their inspiration, and it opens up, and for reasons that I don't think are transferable, Lord knows I wouldn't want to impose this kind of thinking on anybody else. But being around, there's people that I'm around that I find quite stimulating. They just sort of have this joie de vivre, this this sense of a challenge that just seemed to love the is it the energy? Is it the thrill? I don't know. I must ask. For some of my friends, it's that satisfaction. They work in a laboratory, and they have the staff around them, and the work, being able to record so much material now is amazing because you can retrieve it. And when the question changes, the research question changes, you have this body of information. It's like those inventions or discoveries that happened by misadventure. And I think about, a few of them, like aspirin. Common aspirin is a painkiller, and silicone. There's different compounds, different things that we've, different chemistry that that weren't intentional, but just happened to come to the attention of some, very curious and attentive people are working on these projects. I think I like being around those folks. I don't know if I think about Marlowe's work, his body of work, I don't know if that is inspiration to study and to compare and look at Shakespeare and all the Victorian works going on, or whether it's there's people that you're already inspired by some measure, and you're receptive, that you have your mind is open to this arcane way of speaking that nobody actually did, but just flowed as a poetry, and was formed into plays that reveal, what do they reveal? The frailty, the vulnerability, the commonness of insight. Insights about real life, about tragedy, about drama, about comedy. And I don't know if taking somebody into a museum is necessarily going to inspire them and a person in some way, or that child in some way. But I think it does inspire some. Taking a child to, or a person, and if you're elderly and you haven't done it, then you've saved some real treats for yourself. Taking a person to an opera that's never been to one, and then just explaining a little bit of context and letting them go, letting them, and sharing the experience. Now, I wouldn't ever take somebody that's just kicking and screaming, fist balled up and their face turns red. It wouldn't take them around because they have no idea what the hell they're doing. just pushing back on something they've not experienced. However, there are people in the quiet of their lives that tinker, that, may have started off with the AM radio, and then it drifted to FM radio, and then you could buy the material and play it when you chose without any, advertising. And then we added video to it so you could actually see performances. And then what happens? Sometimes you begin to experiment, don't you? Begin to experiment with different types of history. Is it the blues that is the foundation for country western, that is foundation for rock and roll? Is it like that? Some people love that. Well, there's days when days like where I am right now, where it's bleak and there's rain here. So for all the folks that are in a drought situation, it's raining here. You pick up these connections. You see things. Not that everybody in the room is going to make those kind of connections. But what's interesting is this positive impact. This positive impact of the music. I was listening to Seymour Bernstein's a narrative. Piece that was being broadcast about his went from being a performer, a concert performer, to a teacher, an exquisite gentleman, just a beautiful human being. And I watch and you think, the influence, I have to quantify it, I have to, attack this with the same kind of determinist mind that is that I've been, that's been shell-shocked to accept. Not everybody in the room is going to, his audiences were keen, just, that respectful silence, just every note just dripping with emotion and context. Well, but not everybody. So, do we just quash it? If it's not prone to the populist movement, do we just erase it? We do. We see that now. We see the lines being erased. If something isn't materially successful, or we can't produce a profit, then it becomes, it's said in some circles to be irrelevant. Yeah. And now we see the results. There's always consequences for those types of things. The consequences are what we see going on in real life. Some of it we can be quite alarmed about, but if we look beyond that, if we look beyond the insult or the silliness or the grave concern, there's a wonder. We go in these loops, and some of us, out of what are we closing in on 8 billion, some of us notice these loops. Not everybody laid on their back and watching their flocks and looked up at the Milky Way and noticed patterns. Come on, not everybody. Some were saying, come on, we have firewood to collect and we have some game we need to collect, or we're going to starve. Let's get out. There's a preoccupation with the demands of daily living. But there were some night after night when there was quiet, when they noticed, that moves. And that moves, and it's back. And where did it go? And why does it come back? And it comes back. And what else goes on down on the ground here? Well, if you were in ancient Egypt, you would notice some connection. You begin to notice some connection between the seasons and the Nile flooding and what was going on in the heavens. But not everybody, but enough. I know Galileo would have had his mates that would be fascinated with his work. And some would be fascinated because it was heretical. This is dangerous. We need to be careful because if the authorities find out, that's just, no. This is not going to go well for any of us. But the adventure, what are you finding? Tell us what you're discovering and how do you know that? Imagine being his close friend or his confidant and him explaining to you what he had found. Or Newton, being the neighbor. Or Darwin. Or sitting in the cafe with Shakespeare. And listening. What are you working on, Will? And or Seneca or Cicero, imagine just having that privilege of being on the ground floor. Hmm? Anyway, the craft does this to us. It opens their minds. It opens the imagination, and I haven't found the complete loop yet. I haven't. I'm sure there are others out there that have. They see the completeness of it, and they can build a model to express that. I haven't. Like you or many listeners, I'm satisfied being part of the crowd that is fascinated. Well, yeah, a lot of the world points their fingers. What are you guys doing? Really? Don't you have anything better to do? Why don't you get some golf clubs and do something purposeful in life, or pick up a fishing rod? There you go. And yet, a small crowd of us, and even within our memberships, a smaller nucleus within those memberships have been tremendously inspired and quietly going about our work. We're encouraged not to brag, not to create a lot of fanfare, not to go out looking for applause. No, we're encouraged to have some style. What is encouraged is the people don't know that you're faking it. The people think, oh my goodness, you're sophisticated. They don't know that you're just drank the Kool-Aid and somebody suggested that, hey, humility's not, you know, give it a, and then you try it. And what happens? What happens is you take on an air of sophistication. All of a sudden you're examining this feeling of rashness. Well, I wanted to be rash. I wanted to be, you know, judgmental on the spot, but yeah, it's not working. Well, I've got to get to work here today and provide you with a balance. I hope a balance of something useful and something new, an opinion that you can rail against, you can argue or that you can find, hopefully, you can find stimulating. The music, I don't know. I just find music is, for me, it's the voice of mathematics. I want to sit at the foot of Pythagoras and just listen to him explain this to me. And begin to wonder and do my own experiment. Is that accurate? I won't get into what things are true or not. I've reached an age where I'm no judge of that. I just know what I know. And is it accurate? Is this the voice? Well, before I end up sounding like the cat amongst the pigeons, let me just humbly retire and let's bring a focus into this. This is some work by Sonny Rollins, one of my favorites. And you don't know what love is. It's magical stuff. I'll be right back with you. Thanks for sitting in. Fantastic. Thank you. Notice Sonny Rollins, you can imagine just learning the sax and getting into being able to control the notes and then just soaring off along these riffs, just going along. And then he was a very lovely person. He looked around and noticed that people were interested. And my goodness, yeah, we're interested because when we listen to this, some of us are drawn into it. And when you go along with the vibe, or if it's a trio, you see that these handoffs, the music just flows. And I can imagine how excited he was when he was doing that here. Maybe I'm going to take things up a notch or two. In the background, I want you to think about authenticity in terms of intrinsic authenticity or instrumental. Instrumental, where it's a means to an end, and intrinsic, where it's an end in itself. Think about authenticity. We often, you know, the question is, I'll give you my own question. How do I know who I am? How do I know that the way you see me isn't more accurate? Well, and then, you know, you go off onto pouring me another drink, and we'll have that conversation, and then you can tell me your own thoughts. I know. My serene mind is open to licensed pleasure. Authenticity. No amount of effort protects masonry more than carrying on the sense of imagination that has been woven into the stories of a romantic period of masonry that never existed. The history of masonry is less atmospheric and elemental than it is the story of the business of private conversations. Today, the pace of change has quickened. Our beautiful libraries have succumbed to virtual space. Instead of books that, when read, generate deeper questions, the virtual library becomes active with the question asked. It's like the question that prompts us to pick up the book in the first place. Inspiration seems to have been turned on its head. Brotherhood is no longer about familiarity. For reasons that we will explore later, the brotherhood has become faceted. What draws people into this life is now the similarity of taste in music, taste in literature, taste in history and philosophy. The transformation of good to better is channeled through groups with members that interact for the purpose of sharing knowledge in hopes of gaining greater awareness. Presumptuous, isn't it? Sounds like it is very much experiential, but one that is as hard to replicate as the mood brought to mind by the music of Erik Satie or Schumann or Frédéric Chopin. after we have trained and been humbled by the vast amount of available material, our audience is one person. The next one to be influenced by this one. These capable minds have become a unique history. For people who think of these contributions as transferable, the struggle goes on to stumble into creativity by themselves. They find the wonder of authenticity and the isolation that follows. When it works, it's exquisite. When it doesn't, it is just another night attempting the challenge. That's for those who have the confidence. Imagine, imagine being receptive and feeling responsible for that, and being influenced by other people and being an influence to other people. And when you judge that, does that provide a moral foundation for your actions and thinking, for my actions and thinking? Well, it certainly gives me a sense of purpose and an awareness, an understanding of that. But the moods, the discoveries, I don't need an affirmation, somebody saying, oh, you've got it. You know within yourself, when you're experiencing these things that I've talked about in this short paragraph, do you know that it's private? I won't say that it's personal. That's stretching things out. But it will say it's private. What if, and I don't think it's as silly as a secret, a secret that you're a fan of Cézanne's work or Monet or Picasso. That's a secret. You don't want the world to know because it doesn't fit your lifestyle. Or you have a collection of Yo-Yo Ma's work. Is that a secret? Because of what it would do if it was revealed. Bob Dylan taught us about this back in the 60s, when he wrote out like a Rolling Stone. You don't smoke the same cigarette as me. What's it take to be a man? Yeah, let's get started on that. And then we see that apart from all of the bravado and usually when intoxication has loosened a few tongues and increased impulsivity, there is a reality that you are what you are. You are what you make of it, and it's tough. The contribution of the order is that we have these moments where we're encouraged to realize, don't be so foolish to experience the frustration. Think about what you're trying to achieve. Think about the answer. Yes, philosophy is tough. And yes, your first instinct will be to put it down. Resist the impulse. Resist that the first time. And then you go back to it and it's like, oh, gee, this is so. Put it down. Resist it. Resist it a second time and even a third time. And gradually you will learn you're teaching yourself to how to study and how to focus, and you're improving your concentration, not by, hey, man, I want you to improve your concentration, and here's how we're going to do it. Not by that, but by sort of coincidental to what you're taking in. Focus on what you're absorbing. And yeah, some things are going to take longer, and some things are going to be difficult to understand. And some things we're going to need to acknowledge that we don't understand. What to do? Well, throw our hands in the air and walk away, run away. Well, that's not the person that works in the lab, and that's not the person that's going to they're not the alchemists that are satisfied just looking and trying to confirm what the mixtures reveal. This is encouraging us to be the person that can, that does have that ability to control our focus. Yeah. I said it. There's Charlie Parker says it better than me. My, oh my. It's bleak outside today for around here. And I'm always, it always fascinates me because it changes the colors. The colors. I'm in a place that is surrounded by green trees, lots of green. It's almost a fairy tale here. And the colors change, whether in bright sun, there's deep contrast, but in these bleak days, I can see further. You can see further in the forest on bleak days because there's not so much sharp contrast, shadow contrast. It's one of those little advantages that we have. It made me think that, I noticed that there's a few leaves falling off the trees, and it made me think that here the seasons are it's in anticipation that the seasons are going to be changing. And it's coming up. I don't have a season that I don't like, but I find the autumn and the fall very interesting. I was born in the autumn, and I find it fascinating. Just takes us to the precipice of winter, this where everything is stark, and it's like, sit and pay attention here. We put everything to sleep, and oh, my goodness, is it going to come back? Is the sun going to return? And I still feel that. I don't know whether I'm having a I'm channeling some Celtic nature or Pictish kind of nature in me. I hope so. I like to think I could, but it's it made me think about what something significant, particularly with the troubles going on and the people struggling for their freedom, not to be overrun. And fighting back, and nobly, a noble people, the Tartars, are pushing back on this. And I'm speaking, of course, largely about we have the we're acknowledging Dieppe. Is that yesterday the battle? And my country is said to have come of age through the sacrifice. I won't get into the deeper analysis of the poorly trained generals that led a lot of people into an early grave. Won't get into that. That's not the place or the time. But remembrance. And this writer is referred to, Rupert Brooke, by the way, is referred to as the war poet. And if some of you haven't, I'm going to read the fifth. We'll get into the fifth of his sonnets. He wrote a sonnet sequence, and he died in 1915, early in the First World War. So we didn't see, you know, when we look at we see the pictures and we're told the stories. Is it any wonder so many people came back from that war damaged, post-traumatic stress disorder? It hadn't been articulated. Shell shock did. These are the how many of the men and women came back absolutely unable and unwilling to repeat what had happened to them, because they were now we're sensitive enough to know that we can re-traumatize people by doing that, you know, forcing people to talk about the rape. That's just, oof, we're not going to, we know a little better. Who in the hell are we to do that kind of thing? For what? For the sake of good? Come on. Now we're trying to take some responsibility and sort this out. He wrote about this. He was an English, well-born, you know, he's gifted kind of a guy, good looking. He went to school at a place called Rugby, and his dad was the master there. And he distinguished himself as cricket and footballer. And he was a very intelligent guy. And he went on to King's College, Cambridge, where he matriculated in 1906. Prominent in the Fabian, that's that socialist society. You know, we care about it all, and the oligarchs are going to be much help, but they take advantage of the everything for their profit. And he made a lot of friends. So you can imagine he went to Germany to study, and then you think about this into the intellectual honesty of these places in Germany at the time and Italy, and he took, you know, he was one of those, he's like you and I, he took to just wandering through the countryside and just noticing. He was, you know, when you go past a field and you just notice the smell and what's growing, and you have that sense that there's purpose and life is going on. So he spent a year, 1913 and 1914, wandering in the States, and he came to Canada, thank you, and to the South Seas. And then the outbreak of World War I, he received a commission in the Royal Navy. And so he took part in a disastrous expedition in Antwerp that ended in a harrowing retreat. And then he sailed for the Dardanelles, which he never reached. He died of septicemia in a hospital ship in Skyros and was buried in an olive grove on that island. But his sonnets, we'll do the soldier. This is fascinating. It's often considered the war poet. He never wrote about the gritty realities of fighting. Mm-hmm. But he wrote, and the poet belongs to an earlier stage in the war when people were overall more optimistic and patriotic. And This poem was read aloud at St. Paul's Cathedral in Easter 1915, shortly before Brooks' death. And it captures the patriotic mood, and then is The Soldier, with a little analysis of its meaning and language here. This is a sonnet, The Soldier. And it's, I think it's just exquisite. If I should die, think only this of me, that there is some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, the body of England's breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by suns of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less, gives somewhere back the thoughts of England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends and gentleness, and hearts at peace under an English heaven. You see, it's a patriotic message in a poem. And he reminds us, England and English, six times in it. It also offers up that he's proud of patriotism, foreign in the foreign field, forever England in the next line. Now, for a country that suffered or experienced, I won't say suffered, experienced colonialism full on and still is, this is you pick through the remnants and the body count and the fields, and by God, something noble needs to be said, because if not, you shake your head. At least it's a tribute in my own way to women and men and families who have suffered, and some amongst us suffered horrors beyond belief, things that no human should ever see. Ain't that the truth? And yet we learn. Thank you. Cedar Walton, if you want to know. That's pretty cool. That's his Cedar Walton Trio. It's a tune called The Bouncer. If you'll recall from previous episodes that we're tipping into history around The Hague, and we're examining the effect or the consequence of a British, Scottish and English Freemasonry on the continent, what effect did it have? But what we're focusing on here, I think, is really kind of interesting and not without it's got some tentacles that we need to be concerned about. So we'll just jump in here with both feet, particularly on the continent. Masonic rhetoric often referred to the activities of the lodge as domestique, to authority as paternal, to neighboring lodges as sisters, to lodges from which they originated as mothers. Where I am, we still refer to mother lodge. The relationship between the master of a lodge and his brothers had emotional overtones that 18th century men expressed through metaphor that were personal and domestic. A Dutch master of the 1760s addressed his brothers like this: "From his heart, I recommend the interest of the lodge to you with ardor and the paternal love for the brother members." In the same period, a grief-stricken brother wrote to his mother lodge at the death of his wife in childbirth, "And his ardent wish that the child who had been saved will see the light with you, my tenderly loved mother, la bien amie." We've mentioned that lodge quite a few times. The lodge responded with compassion, referring to his deceased wife as our sister, although she was almost certainly not a member of a women's lodge. Now, the ideal of the domestic was intimately connected to the ambiance and values of the lodge, yet it was intended to be a separate sphere, domestic and the lodge. Predictably, lodges often chose women as their symbols. Minerva was a favorite, and Masonic iconography made much of her. She could be wisdom or enlightenment. She could also symbolize a republic. La Bien Amie chose for its emblem a woman, gray with old age, wearing a white veil. Her age was meant to symbolize the antiquity of true friends and our noble order. Every item she wore, every posture and gesture of her hands was endowed with a carefully described symbolism. She was, among her many virtues, a faithful wife. And here's the question. If the lodges were analogs to the home, intended to inculcate the virtues associated with domesticity, brotherly affection, fidelity, loyalty, devotion to work, and so forth, then why should this fraternity remain exclusively male? The question was asked early in the century, and by mid-century, some lodges chose to respond to it by establishing lodges of both men and women. And as we shall see, the earliest known records of such a lodge are dated 1751, and it met in The Hague. Almost certainly, the mixed lodges, or lodges of adoption, as they were somewhat inexplicably called, date from slightly earlier, probably the 1740s. So 1717, 1740. So 23 years, 27 years, yeah. Creating new constitutional societies brought to the surface all the limitations of access imposed by birth or education, which were inherent in the new constitutionalism. those limitations now concern us. We have given a willing suspension of disbelief to these fraternal proceedings. We have approached them on their own terms. Yet, if we are at the historical moment when constitutional societies are being created privately in almost every European country, then we may legitimately ask, for whom was the new civil society created? For men, the answer presents itself, who were highly literate, prosperous, usually from the skilled professions, and in some cases well-born and titled. Divisions of rank, birth, and wealth were never obliterated in the lodges, whatever their rhetoric and ideals, and women were simply excluded from the forms of civil society. But as with all matters Masonic, the answer to which we now turn was not quite that simple. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We see that we're drawing to a close. Again, it happens. I want to thank you for the time that you've shared, tuned in with us, and to listeners from around the world, from Turkey to New Zealand to Latvia and China. I'm quite pleased to host you for a short period of time in Oman and South Sudan. I'm quite happy that you're finding us making a contribution, and to Britain and to Ireland. I'm chuffed. Thanks. I hope we have some relevance to you and say something useful, and that you go about your week with a sense of optimism that we can have these conversations. And many of you, I am sure, have conversations and good mates that eclipse anything that I might be able to contribute. And good on you. The craft is going to be taking a few knocks for the next couple of years. Is sorting, you know, it's hard to be so so clear about who's going to, you know, do well and take advantage of the advantages or make advantage of what happens within masonry. So we need somebody that's a bit more cerebral. And who's to judge who that is? Well, you and I are the, come on, that comes with the territory. We're going to do that. And we can't do that just arbitrarily. You can't do that alone. You know, that's discussion. And you get into the discussion, and as gentlemen, you find the pushback. Keep the park the irritation. You know, keep that to yourself. That's unflattering, and you're only going to, if you're prone to that, you're only embarrassing yourself. But because you're, when we're old, we're never right. We're never right. When we're irritated, we're never right. Sorry. There's a lot going on, and many listeners will be finding a strength in the teachings of masonry, and that will be evident, not on display, but it will be evident. And for that, we can all be thankful. Committing acts of random Masonic kindness. I love that. Jerry Garcia, guitarist with a band from the 60s called the Grateful Dead, used to say that. Commit those acts of random Masonic random kindness. I add random Masonic kindness. Come back and see us. It's a pleasure. I'm at masonicfx@gmail.com if you're inclined. And thanks. We'll see you soon.